to Psy.
Spend the day with Psy.
From 6 a.m. to 9:30 p.m. on Radio Psy Thursday Live.
Radio Psy Thursday Live.
Sai Ram and welcome to this week's Radio Sai Answering Booth. This is Prem, your friend from Team Radio Sai, and this is a program where I invite questions on practical spirituality from listeners and I answer them on the basis of Swami's message, of course. It just thrills me no end to realize how Swami has covered every topic of concern that we will have doubts on. Sometimes we do this mistake of saying that Swami's message is too ideal. It is not pragmatic for day-to-day life. But I've even heard devotees saying, but Swami said this in the 60s and 70s. How can this be applicable for modern times? Yes, sometimes we have to use our discrimination even in the application of Swami's message. But let us remember that Swami's message is eternal and eternally applicable. As Swami would say, He is Satya Sanatana and Nitya Nutana. He is eternal truth but forever young and new. My humble opinion is, let us not approach Swami's message that way. That it needs modification, that it needs our discrimination to make it applicable. Let us approach Swami's message with faith and earnestness. Let us believe that, yes, this will work even now. If we are able to approach with that sincerity, I'm sure that even if we go wrong or if we have misunderstood it, Swami will himself find ways of correcting our course. See, it's like this. We have an issue before us and we have a solution in the form of Swami. If we prioritize solving the issue, then we will only use Swami's word and use it through our discrimination, right? But if we say, forget the issue, my priority is not solving the issue, my priority is sticking to Swami's solution, then we will not be bothered whether the issue is solved or not. We will only be asking, am I doing as per Swami's will? Isn't it? Then we will not be bothered whether the issue is solved or not. And when this happens, one, my focus is not the problem. Two, the solution to the problem is no more my headache. It becomes Swami's responsibility. For this attitude, all that we have to do is love Swami and of course, love Him more with every passing day. Till we surrender completely this ego and reason. Course, in the second part of today's show, I will be telling one story, a classic story, one of my favorite stories that stands for this message. But that is, of course, not before the question of the day, for after all, this is the answering booth, and questions are really the bread and butter of the show, if I can put it that way. But even the question will have to wait till I'm done with the quote I wish to read for you this week. Today is a special day in India. It happens to be the 68th Republic Day of India, a day when one of the greatest civilizations in the world reorganized itself to be governed by a constitution of democratic nature. A day when India became a sovereign, socialist, secular, democratic republic, as we call it. There have been many freedom struggles for nationhood around the globe. But if we are to truly study history keenly, those movements that were led by people who were motivated by a higher sense of justice and, dare I say, spiritual understanding and motives, stand out among them. These movements are special compared to the others. The story of the formation of the Republic of India is for sure one of them. It was not merely led by political leaders, but by men and women of highest sacrifice and spiritual orientation who happened to be political leaders. Today I wish to read the words of one such inspirational personality. If you are an Indian, your hair is sure to stand on its end even when I merely mention the name of this hero, this glorious son of Bharat. He is Shaheed Bhagat Singh. And these are words from his prison diaries, words that he wrote when he awaited his execution. I quote, "The aim of life is no more to control the mind, but to develop it harmoniously. Not to achieve salvation hereafter, but to make the best use of it there, here below. And not to realize truth, beauty and goodness only in contemplation, but also in the actual experience of daily life. Social progress depends not upon the ennoblement of the few, but on the enrichment of democracy. Universal brotherhood can be achieved only when there is an equality of opportunity in the social, political and individual life." End of quote. These were the words of a hero who was barely 25 years old, dear listeners. What a profound spiritual truth he is speaking about here. He says, forget about achieving salvation in the afterlife. Use this life for now. And use it for what? To bring concepts such as truth, beauty and goodness from the realms of contemplation to the realms of everyday reality. Not just for oneself, but for others too. Atmano mokshartam jagat hitaya cha, declares the Rig Veda. As you strive for liberation, that striving should also benefit the world around you. Otherwise, our thirst for salvation is nothing more than a refined sense of selfishness and self-interest. Finally, he says, universal brotherhood can be achieved only when there is equality in opportunity. Not equality of wealth, status of authority or authority, but equality in opportunity. One of our lecturers was once sharing with us that he would constantly contemplate and wonder, what does Swami mean when he says help ever? What help are we supposed to do? How much can we really help? On contemplation, he said, he felt what Swami really wants us to do is help ever to empower. Help people in such a way that you empower them to pursue opportunity. Help people in such a way that they don't need your help anymore. It is then that we are contributing to equality of opportunity. On speaking about the idea of communism and socialism, Swami said this in a discourse. He said, the idea is noble that all should be equal. But there can never be equality in possessions because all do not have equal desires. But what we must strive for is to offer equality in opportunity. Now you will agree with the statement I made before I read the quote, that this movement of Indian independence was led not by political leaders or extremists, but spiritual aspirants and men and women of ideals and principles. They had such thoughts, and this hero at such a young age had such thoughts. What more can I say but salute this land that gave birth to such spiritual lions? Before we move ahead, permit me, dear listeners, to read once more the words of Shaheed Bhagat Singh. I quote, "The aim of life is no more to control the mind, but to develop it harmoniously. Not to achieve salvation hereafter, but to make the best use of it here below. And not to realize truth, beauty and good only in contemplation, but also in the actual experience of daily life. Social progress depends not upon the ennoblement of the few, but the enrichment of democracy. Universal brotherhood can be achieved only when there is an equality of opportunity in social, political, and individual life." Finally, coming to the question of the day. The question is from a regular listener who has sent us questions before too. The question is from Dr. Vaishali Dinkar from Pune. It's again quite a small question, so I will read out the question myself. And this is a question. "I have one very general question. This is a question I get from many others, though I am aware of the answer, but I want you to answer so that I can use it for further reference while I answer others as a part of my profession or otherwise as advice. what is the difference between yoga and physical exercise? Well, thank you for that question, Sister Vaishali. Being a doctor, I'm sure you do have a fair idea about the difference between yoga and physical exercise. But I presume that you wish to know Swami's explanation and, of course, the general differentiation from the spiritual point of view. Because anything that is traditionally a part of Indian heritage cannot be spoken of without making references to the spiritual perspective. Indian cultural heritage and spirituality is inseparable. I should probably give you an alert that in my answer I will be speaking more about yoga than regular exercise, but we'll try and contrast the two as and when possible in the course of the answer. First and foremost, when we say yoga, we are actually referring to yogasana. And yogasana is just one of the eight aspects of Patanjali's Ashtanga Yoga. The eight angas or parts being yama, niyama, asana, pranayama, pratyahara, dharana, dhyana and samadhi. The Ashtanga Yoga is just one of the many types of yogas. So what is yoga? The word yoga comes from the word yuj, which means to yoke or to connect to. So in spirituality, yoga means a method of connecting to and staying connected to divinity. In other words, it is a pathway to God or a pathway to our inner divinity or self-realization as we wish to call it. That's why in scriptures we have references to bhakti yoga, which is the path of devotion, jnana yoga, the path of wisdom, or many such yogas like karma yoga, raja yoga, sankhya yoga and so on. So when we say yoga in what we understand as the physical yoga that we do, it is this. Of the many ways to attain God, Ashtanga Yoga of Patanjali is one. Of the eight limbs of Patanjali's yoga, asana is just one. So even if we consider that we do what is called pranayama too, at best what we call yoga is 1/4 of Patanjali's yoga. So in other words, yogasanas and pranayama are included as a necessary means for the pathway to God by Patanjali. The goal is spiritual, and this technique to keep the body healthy was just a means. Was it to keep the body healthy or is there more to it? We'll come to that after some time. But to be able to compare yoga and exercise, I think we'll need to see why physical exercises were created in the first place, right? We will have to look a little into the history of exercising for that. For many, many centuries, civilizations did not have the concept of physical exercise at all. Because most of the activity that people were doing in everyday life was enough for the fitness of the body, be it working in the farm, chopping wood, cooking, tending to cattle, etc. There was no need for exercise, and hence the concept of exercise did not exist. If at all anyone had physical training, it was the men in the army. They would have fitness camps to improve their endurance, their ability to run, walk long distances, swim, climb, training in wrestling, throwing spears and weights and so on. And all of these activities were necessary for improving physical strength and endurance in the context of war. Slowly, these were later developed into sports by the Greek. That's why initially sports competitions were nothing but physical activities that would be used in warfare. Hand combat, sword fighting, running, chariot and horse races and so on. Then later, the Romans started the concept of gymnasiums or public gymnasiums. And the idea of that was to celebrate the beauty of the human body. They made it fashionable and a part of their culture to have a fit, proportional and good-looking physique. They promoted it through public gymnasiums and even through their art, by eulogizing physical beauty, as we can see even today in Roman architecture and sculptures. But with time, this idea of physical fitness for all was propagated, but still with the idea of war preparedness. When they found that their countries could be attacked any time from any side, they wanted that the young men in the country should have a general level of fitness and endurance, so that they will be in a state of readiness to join the army as and when there was a need. And around this time, when Christianity started spreading, that is from, say, the 5th to the 15th century, this idea of physical beauty and giving importance to the human body was heavily challenged. The idea that this body is a carrier of sin and it should be abhorred and ignored came into vogue. Still, fitness for military purposes continued side by side, but the exercises were designed again to cater to the needs of warfare, and even sports were designed around military needs alone. The public gymnasiums and regular exercises were slowly done away with in this period. Then came the Industrial Revolution in the mid-18th century, and with it came automations. So after centuries of manual labor, slowly we were entering the phase of a sedentary lifestyle. Of course, it happened very, very gradually and slowly, but it was in this period that educators began speaking about introducing physical fitness training in schools. Sports, gymnastics and such began becoming popular as part of the education system. So in this period, exercise was meant to replace manual labor which had reduced. And most of what we consider exercise today, like jogging, going to a gym for workouts, are trends that caught up much later in the 20th century. And after that, we saw what happened. It happened with everything else in 20th century, so it happened with the concept of physical exercise too. Fitness became a huge industry, commercialization in a massive scale followed, and we were given standards of health like six-packs, V-shaped bodies, size zero, all of which have very little to do with good health, and we were sent on a race to fit into these descriptions laid out by the fitness industry, which actually became the fashion industry. The reason why I went to the history of exercising is, from this we can see what was meant to be the purpose of exercising at all. Though the purpose the individual has in mind does matter, when a certain system has been created with a certain purpose, the system will have an inbuilt nature too. So in that sense, modern exercises were created to achieve battle fitness, an attractive appearance, and health in the sense of countering a sedentary lifestyle. Of course, in the process, the idea that exercising does influence the state of mind was also established, and doctors would ask us to do exercise for that purpose too. For example, now we have clearly established that endorphins are secreted when we do exercise, and endorphins help us fight stress, be in a general good state of mind, and so on. But predominantly, physical exercises, as the name suggests, was meant for the physical. And so they were developed with that purpose in mind. Now, so far, I have only been giving the history from the point of view of the West, right? And more so, the popular culture. But the case was quite different in the East, or the Orient as we call it, and even within some ancient civilizations in the West itself. For instance, in the East, we have the practices of martial arts, through which they always taught a larger context than just physical fitness or self-defense. But we will, of course, stick to yoga, for that is what the question is about. Now, talking about yoga or yogasanas, as I mentioned, the primary purpose was to help a person progress spiritually. So when a system of physical fitness is designed with the idea that it will help one progress spiritually, the approach of that system will be completely different. The way you assess yourself if you are progressing following that system will also have to differ, right? So at the very outset, if you consider yourself a spiritual aspirant, it goes without saying that yoga is the best option for you. So if I'm not keen on spirituality, well, whether a person claims to be on the spiritual path or not, we all are on the spiritual path. Some are probably like the kindergarten children who go to school but have no idea that they're going to a school and will be doing that for the rest of their childhood. But a school-going kid in the higher classes will have the idea. Similarly, whether we acknowledge it or not, we are all on the spiritual path. And that also corrects one of our misconceptions about yoga. We tend to think that yoga is for yogis, not for regular worldly people like us, or whom Swami would refer to as bogies, right? Swami would say that this is a big mistake. Why do we think like this? One of the reasons I feel is because of how we see exercise. I think many of us think that these yogis had to sit and do meditation the whole day, so they must have devised some of these exercises to keep themselves fit. Well, sounds like a sound logic, doesn't it? But since yoga was never about just the body, this argument does not stand. Another reason I can think of why yoga was not just for yogis is that the Ashtanga Yoga, the first step of which is called Yama, or moral conduct in society. And Swami would explain that Yama has 5 sub-principles, Satya, Ahimsa, Aparigraha, Asteya and Brahmacharya, where Satya and Ahimsa is truth and non-violence, Aparigraha and Asteya, non-violent, non-stealing and non-desiring for gifts, and Brahmacharya, of course, is celibacy. The first 4, you will agree, are clearly meant for people living in the society, right? For regular people like us. Maybe celibacy could confuse us a bit. We may think that celibacy is a concept for sadhus and sannyasis. But in one of Swami's discourses, he very beautifully explains that there are different types of celibacy that we have to follow. For example, a married man, when in the presence of a woman other than his wife, should become a celibate. A married woman should become a celibate when in the presence of men other than her husband. So clearly, Ashtanga Yoga is not for yogis in the forest, who are living in the forest, but for all of us who are living in the society. But its purpose was not merely for beauty, strength, or even health for that matter. To understand the difference between regular exercise, which as I said is a modern concept, and yoga, we will have to see how different is the concept of the human being itself when it comes to these 2 approaches. In the modern approach, we consider ourselves as a body-mind complex at best. What is the Vedantic perspective of the human being? It is this. At the core, we are divine, and this divine core is encased in 5 sheaths or 5 koshas, as it is called in Sanskrit. The most gross is called the Annamaya Kosha or the food sheath. Below that is the Pranamaya Kosha or the sheath of life energy. Then there is Manomaya Kosha or the sheath of the mind. Then comes Vijnanamaya Kosha or that of the intellect. And the 5th is called Anandamaya Kosha or the sheath of bliss. So this is the human being according to the ancient Bharatiya culture. What we call the Annamaya Kosha alone is the gross physical body. So physical exercise is confined to only this Annamaya Kosha or the human body made of food and water. At best, it makes probably references to the mind sheet, but predominantly it is concerned only about the Annamaya Kosha. So the approach of the Ashtanga Yoga is this. When an equilibrium is maintained in each of these koshas, one will be able to go within up to the Anandamaya Kosha, the experience of limitless bliss. And with further effort, one can transcend even that state of bliss and reach the inner divinity. And the 8-step yoga is meant to reach equilibrium in each of these sheaths. So we can say yoga is not about exertion or spending excess energy through physical activity, but a method by which we can reach a certain inner balance. When we do physical exercise, we see if we are sweating enough, are we getting strained enough, are we feeling pain in the right places and so on. But when we do yoga, after a yoga session, we must feel refreshed and rejuvenated. The whole day the mind should feel calm. With regular practice of yoga, our anger and stress must come down. We must not feel stiffness in our muscles, rather we must feel suppleness. So a yoga instructor will always say one thing, do as much as you can, don't push yourself too hard, remain within your abilities. Slowly you will be able to do more and better. That's because the goal of yoga is to go closer towards that bliss within. So calmness, rejuvenation and happiness is the true indication of progress when it comes to yoga. One more attribute in which there is a clear difference when it comes to yoga is the importance given to breathing. As I mentioned, yoga is not meant to deal only with Annamaya Kosha, right? So, which is the next sheath? We call it the Pranamaya Kosha. Again, sorry. Again, there are five pranas that form this kosha, and primary among them is breath. Some would say that even if you run a mile, our breathing should not become uneven, and this can be achieved through the practice of yoga. And how do they incorporate this? One main method is through pranayama. And there are many types of pranayama, but it is said that most of the health issues of the body can be taken care of just through the practice of these pranayamas. There may be five pranas, one for digestion, one for handling the energy and the nerve system, one for excretion and one for speech and so on. But all of these can be effectively maintained in equilibrium through pranayama. For instance, Swami would explain, the most common type of pranayama that we all do is called anulom vilom pranayama, where we breathe in through the left nostril, hold our breath, and then exhale through the right nostril, and then repeat it through the other way around. Swami would say that the Ida and Pingala nadis, which actually are the most important parts of the Vyana Prana system, pass through the left and right nostril respectively. So when we do this pranayama, these nadis are actually activated. The other common pranayama is Kapalabhati, right? This helps the Samana Prana, which is in charge of the digestion. So this entire pranamaya kosha is taken care of by doing pranayama. And most of the asanas too are meant to activate the nadis and chakras, which actually form a part of the pranamaya kosha. So apart from this standalone breathing exercise, even while performing asanas, they suggest that a particular breathing pattern is to be followed. Of course, the modern variants of yoga differ in this. For example, I believe even the famous Iyengar yoga does not insist that there should be a strict breathing pattern while doing yogasanas. But traditional Patanjali yoga had pranayama to an extent integrated into the postures itself. So just these two aspects of Ashtanga yoga, asana and pranayama, take care of this gross body and also the energy system within. And when these two are in equilibrium, to a great extent, the mind will be calm. But for complete health, physical, mental and psychological, at least the first four steps of Patanjali's yoga have to be practiced. That is, yama, niyama and asana and pranayama. Because yama and niyama are means of self-discipline. Yama, as I explained, is discipline in our interaction with society. And niyama is self-discipline. Be it cleanliness, ceiling on desires, discipline in food and habits, all of these come under what we call niyama. And Swami would say, nashreyo niyamam vina. Without self-restraint and self-discipline, there can be no wellness. So to have true health as described by the World Health Organization, that is a state of complete physical, mental and social well-being and not merely the absence of disease or infirmity, we must follow as best as we can yama, niyama, asana and pranayama. But if we wish to proceed towards discovering our divinity, then the next three steps become mandatory. That is pratyahara or slow withdrawal of senses, dharana or one-pointed concentration, and dhyana or meditation. And these will eventually lead to samadhi. Well, samadhi does not mean death or end of life. It is complete absorption in the self within, a state of absolute undisturbed peace, a state of union with divinity. It does not mean death, just a state of supreme stillness and serenity. It is said that the first four steps of the Ashtanga Yoga are Bahiranga aspects or external, the last four are Antaranga or internal aspects. So finally, I will conclude with just one point. I had mentioned that the purpose behind the creation of these systems are important. But after all this, I can use yoga only to have an attractive body. Yes, yoga will help even if one does it purely for physical fitness and physical appearance. But then it would be like, as Swami says, using a kalpavriksham only for coffee powder. A kalpavriksham will give coffee powder if you ask it. But that is not the limitation of the tree, but limitation of our sense of purpose. Similarly, people might be following regular physical exercise, but be clear that it is meant to maintain health so that one can concentrate on higher goals. I am sure that will have its benefits too. But as Swami would say, this system of yoga is so comprehensive the weak can do, the sick can do it, even old people can do and benefit from it. And this system has been created by sages who have completely understood the body. Swami says in a discourse that we have forgotten the science completely in India. Some people exported it to the West, they benefited from it, and then they came and told us that it is so beneficial. And then we have started following it. How unfortunate we are. So definitely yoga is a far more comprehensive regime for fitness too, as well as for general wellness. I hope I could clarify some doubts that you had or could offer some reinforcements that you were seeking. So thank you, Sister Vaishali, for asking the question. You being a doctor yourself, you chose to ask us this question, so thank you for that. If you have anything more to ask on this topic, you can always write to me at prem@radiosai.org. Coming now to the next part of the program, and as I promised you, I promised to tell you a beautiful story, a story which definitely we've heard in front of from Swami, we've heard it being enacted in Swami's presence, we've heard it being spoken in Swami's presence. There are many versions to this story, but the version I'm going to tell you is the version that I like the most, of course, and of course it has got my own reinforcements to it. So I hope you will like the story, and this is a very beautiful story on what true devotion really is. The story goes that once in the kingdom of Mathura, one fine morning, Krishna wakes up and he says, I'm having this splitting headache. You see, he starts wriggling in pain and he's crying and cribbing, and he says, somebody please help me, I'm having this headache which is so very overpowering, I don't know what to do about this headache. The royal physicians are called. The two wives of Krishna, Satyabhama and Rukmini, are on the either side. They don't know what to do. They call the physicians of the land. They all come and test it. They're not able to do anything about this pain which he's having. No medicines seem to be working on the Lord. The Lord is wriggling and twisting in pain. Krishna keeps saying, do something about it, my head is splitting. So then the physicians fold their hands in submission and they tell the Lord that, Lord, our science and knowledge is nothing before you. So if you want us to help you, you should tell us what is the medicine that will cure your ailment. So then Krishna tells them that, okay, there is an unconventional solution to my headache. Krishna looks at the gathering there and tells that, get me the water after washing the feet of a genuine devotee of mine. And if I am to take that water, what we call Charanamritam, this headache will go. And all of them are perplexed, they're looking at each other. Satyabhama looks at Rukmini and tells her, Sister Rukmini, can there be a devotee greater than you? You are the greatest devotee of the Lord. Among the many people whom you could have chosen as your master, as your husband, you chose Lord Krishna and Krishna accepted you. So where can we find a devotee greater than you? You are the greatest devotee of the Lord. So you should be offering that Charanamrit to the Lord. And Rukmini thought for a moment and he said, how can I do that? This is my husband, this is my master, this is the Lord. How can I take the water after washing my feet and offer it to the Lord? So Rukmini looks at Satyabhama and says, Sister Satyabhama, can there be a devotee greater than you? Because though your means were wrong, though your means were a little primitive, you are one who always wants to possess the Lord for oneself. You always wanted to make Krishna yours and yours alone. So how can there be a devotee greater than you? That attitude is what is devotion. And you have that attitude and you're so strong in that. So definitely you're the greatest devotee of the Lord. Please offer your Charanamritam and let us give it to the Lord and relieve him of his pain. And Satyabhama says that, how can I do that? In no way is my devotion perfect. And even if it is, I cannot do this blasphemous act of offering my Charanamrit to the Lord. And when this is going on, Krishna is still wriggling in pain and he's crying out. He says, my head is splitting. Why aren't you doing anything about it? So Mother Rukmini and Satyabhama decide to call upon another great devotee of the Lord. They say that why don't we call sage Narada? Because he is the one who is going around the world at all the time chanting the name of the Lord, singing the praise of the Lord. So let's call out to Narada. So then they call out to Narada, and Narada comes there and he hears this whole thing. And Narada says, how can I offer the Charanamrita of my feet? He is the Lord, he is the master. I redeem my life by chanting his name. If I were to take this water from my after washing my feet and give it to the Lord, I would be thrown into the darkest dungeons of hell. How could a devotee do this? And they say that no, there is no way I can offer this. So when this deliberation is going on, they don't know what to do. They again turn to Lord Krishna and they say, Krishna, who will be prepared to offer you this medicine that you're asking for? You say that you want it from a true devotee. How can there be a true devotee who will agree to this plan of offering you this Charanamritam that you're asking for? So Lord Krishna tells them that probably you can go and try in Vrindavan. There will be at least one person, and I know there is one person who will do it. And so Narada is sent on the mission to Vrindavan to bring this weird medication that the Lord wanted for his relentless headache. So he goes there, and there, after entering the Vrindavan, he finds the Gopalas, the playmates of Krishna, who have seen Krishna through his childhood days, who have loved him as a friend, later they loved him as a leader, and eventually they loved him as their Lord. So he goes to the Gopalas who played with Krishna, and he says, he narrates the whole story that Krishna in Mathura is having this splitting headache, and he wants the Charanamrita of a true devotee. The Gopalas look at Narada and they point out to the Govardhana hill. They say, Narada, do you see that hill there? That massive hill, the Govardhana hill. Do you know when Krishna was a little boy, barely in his teens, he lifted that entire hill in the little finger of his left hand. Do you realize the might of the Lord? Do you realize who Krishna is? We have seen him perform miracles that you cannot imagine. He is single-handedly, as a little boy, as a toddler, killed great asuras. He is the same Lord. Krishna is none other than Lord Mahavishnu himself. Don't you realize that this is just a maya? This is just his maya that he is performing, and how can he be having a headache, and how can he ask for the Charanamrita of a devotee? Well, of course, in the back of their minds, they too knew that the repercussions of offering their Charanamrita, the water from their feet, to the Lord is the greatest of blasphemy that a devotee can think of. So they were reasoning this way. They said that it must be the maya of the Lord. There can be no way that the Lord really needs this as a medication. So Narada is disappointed. So he goes to the place where the gopis are filling water in the Yamuna. And we all know the devotion of the gopis. We have heard it being extolled by Swami himself on many, many occasions. So Narada goes to the gopis and he is sure that finally the Charanamrita which he is searching will be found, will be given by the gopis. So he goes to them and he sees that they are singing songs of Krishna, they are lost in the consciousness of Krishna. Even as they are filling water in their pots, they were singing praises of Krishna and chanting Krishna, Krishna. He goes to them and he starts narrating this whole issue that he has come, which has brought him to Vrindavan. The moment Narada says that Krishna is having a splitting headache and he is not able to even sit or lie down, many of the gopis swoon into a faint because they are not able to bear this thought that Krishna is suffering. And many of them start wailing and crying, and they turn to Narada and ask, so what is the solution? What can we do? Do you want our lives? We are ready to die for Krishna. You can take our lives if that is going to put an end to Krishna's headache. Narada is very, very moved by their devotion, and he is sure that the solution lies amongst the gopis. So he says that the solution to the headache, the medication, was given by Lord Krishna himself. So he explains that Krishna said, go to somebody who is a true devotee of mine, wash their feet worshipfully, and bring me that Charanamrita or the water after washing their feet. If I consume that, my headache will be abated. And Narada feels that here are the Gopikas, they are illiterate after all, they are, you know, women engaged in selling and procuring milk. So he thought probably they will not be aware of, you know, the consequences of one's actions, what happens after birth, I mean after death, there is a life after death. So he begins describing to them the concept of karma. He said, you know, I should warn you what happens if you perform an act like this. So he tells them that, you know, Krishna is the Lord, you are the devotee. If you take the dust from your feet and that is consumed by the Lord, there can be nothing more sacrilegious than that. That will be the highest of blasphemy to be performed by a devotee, because we know that, you know, we as children are taught that even our legs should not be placed on the book or a pen, because that represents Goddess Saraswati. But here is the devotee being asked to offer the dust of their feet for the consumption of the Lord himself. So, you know, Narada explains this whole thing and he says, so after death there's a possibility that you'll end up in the darkest dungeons in the hell and you'll be there for the rest of eternity, because that is the intensity of the blasphemy that you'll be performing, that if you agree to this proposal. Now the Gopikas start thinking. The Gopikas say that, do you think really Krishna will be in need of this, because Krishna always keeps playing with us? And they start recollecting the incidents of how Krishna multiplied himself, and they did the Rasa Leela with them, and they recall occasions when he annihilated enormously powerful asuras. They say, is it possible that our Krishna can really be in this state? I think he is just playing with us. And now there is a bit of confusion even in the Gopika's mind. And even as this was happening, Narada realizes that even these Gopikas, after knowing the complete reality, probably will not be forthcoming to offer the Charanamrit as Krishna was asking for. And just then comes this devotee of the Lord, whom we all are so very fond of. Even the name of this devotee thrills our heart and fills it with love. Mother Radha comes. And the whole thing is again narrated to her, and she's told that here is Krishna, he is having this headache, he wants this as a cure for his headache. And when this is told to her, Mother Radha says immediately, you know, she says, bring water, wash my feet and take it. I don't know if I am the best of devotees, I don't even know if I am a devotee, but if I am, if this can solve the problem, why not? Please do wash my feet and take that water right away to Krishna. So now Narada says, oh, here is another illiterate gopi, I need to educate her as to what happens. So then they tell her, then first Narada tells her that, you know, Mother Radha, don't you know that Krishna is Lord Vishnu himself? And Radha says, yes, I know, he is the Lord himself. Don't you know that this is a game of Maya that he is playing? Then Radha looks at Narada and says, O sage Narada, if this is the game of Maya that my Krishna chooses to play, then who am I, this individual, to resist it? I will play along. If he is pretending to have a headache, and if he is pretending that this is the solution for it, I will play along. Please take that Charanamrit. Don't delay. Then Narada explains that, Mother, don't you know what will be the consequences of this action? You will be in the darkest dungeons of hell forever. Do you realize the consequences of your action? And then Radha looks at him and says, so what? So what if that is going to be the result of my action? Do you agree that if you take this as a medicine to Krishna, his headache will go? Narada says, yes, I believe so, because that's what Krishna said. Then where is the question of what will happen after that? If it will relieve my Krishna, that is enough. If for that relief that I can give to my Lord for a few moments, if I have to spend ages and ages of eternity in the darkest of hells, this Radha is prepared for that. And at that moment, Narada falls to his knees, and all the gopis and gopalas around fall to their knees, and they realize what an epitome of devotion and love that Radha was. Because love is always giving, and in our relation to Swami too, many times most of us have come to Swami to gain something, to receive something, to, it could even be blessings and grace, but always our relationship with Swami is about us receiving something. But somewhere down the line, somewhere along as we go in this relationship of love with Swami or with our God or chosen deity, at some point the relationship has to turn on its heads when we say, Lord, what you want is what I am here to offer. I'm not here to accept and ask for more. Is there anything that I can offer you? Is there anything that I can give you? And at some point in this relationship, this prioritization reverses, where we said, I am a devotee, I have a life, I want welfare, I want good things to happen to me, and here is a Lord who can give it to me. And if I can offer my love and devotion to Him, I can take care of myself and my welfare. At some point, this priority reverses and he says, I don't care about myself. I don't care of what I want. I don't care of what my ego thinks is right and wrong. I don't care about my reasoning. I am here to offer myself at your feet and ask, what does my Lord want? And in our journey, when that change happens, it is then that it really becomes devotion, as Swami would call it. That devotion that Radha stood for was called Madhura Bhakti, the devotion which was sweetest. When we talk of Radha, when we talk of devotees like Meera or many others, we only talk of the pain, or we think of the pain that they go through. But Swami calls it Madhura Bhakti, which is sweet devotion or the sweetest form of devotion. So somewhere lost in that maya of all the pain and suffering that these devotees put forth in front of us, was hidden the highest form of sweetness. And that form of sweetness will never be achieved unless this reversal of priorities happens, where we say, what I want is secondary, what I think is right and wrong is secondary. Swami, what you want, what you ask of me, is of greatest importance to me. Dear listeners, it's end of this program, Radio Sai Answering Booth. I thank Sister Vaishali for sending a question. If you have a question, especially on practical spirituality of how to apply Swami's message on day-to-day life, as I explained in that beautiful story, at some point we should not ask how to better my life, but what is the best way to deal with this life, and that is Swami's way. And if you have a situation in your life, if you have a situation in any of your friends or family's life, and you feel you want to know what would Swami probably expect of us when we are in such a situation, if you have a question like that, you can send it to me, and you can send it to prem@radiosai.org. That's prem@radiosai.org. The mail sent to this mail ID will be read only by me, so confidentiality is guaranteed. If you don't want me to mention your name on the program, you can let me know. I most humbly offer this effort at Swami's lotus feet, and I thank you all for your very patient listening. I'll be back with you in about half an hour's time for the afternoon satsang, but for the next episode of Radio Sai Answering Booth, you'll have to wait for another week. Next Thursday at 11 a.m, I'll be back with you for Radio Sai Answering Booth. పట పాడుమా కృష్ణం పలుకుతేనే లొలుకునటుల పాటలాడుమా ముకుంద మనసు తీరగా పట పాడుమా కృష్ణ పలుకుతేనే లొలుకునటుల
श्याम राधे कोई ना कहता, कहते राधे श्याम।
श्याम राधे कोई नहीं कहता, कहता राधे श्याम।
श्याम राधे कोई ना कहता, कहते राधे श्याम। जन्म जन्म के भाग जगा दे एक राधा का नाम। आ
राधा के बिना श्याम आधा, राधा के बिना श्याम आधा, कहते राधे श्याम। जन्म जन्म के भाग जगा दे एक राधा का नाम। बोलो राधे, बोलो राधे, बोलो राधे राधे राधे, बोलो राधे। राधा के बिना श्याम आधा, कहते राधे श्याम। जन्म जन्म के भाग जगा दे एक राधा का नाम। बोलो राधे, बोलो राधे, बोलो राधे राधे राधे, बोलो राधे।
व्यर्थ पड़ा माला बिन मोती, व्यर्थ रहे दीपक बिन ज्योति। व्यर्थ पड़ा माला बिन मोती, व्यर्थ रहे दीपक बिन ज्योति। चंदा बिना चांदनी कैसी, सूरज बिना धूप न होती।
व्यर्थ पड़ा माला बिन मोती व्यर्थ रहे दीपक बिन ज्योति चंदा बिना चांदनी कैसी सूरज बिना धूप न होती बिन राधा के कहाँ है पूरा नटनागर का नाम बोलो राधे बोलो राधे बोलो राधे 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 बोलो राधे श्री राधा को जिसने भुलाया उसने अपना जन्म गवाया श्री राधा को जिसने भुलाया उसने अपना जन्म गवाया धन्य हुई वो प्राणी जिसने राधे श्याम नाम है गाया श्री राधा को जिसने भुलाया उसने अपना जन्म गवाया धन्य हुई वो प्राणी जिसने राधे श्याम नाम है गाया उनका सुमिरन करे बिना कब मिलता है विश्राम बोलो राधे बोलो राधे बोलो राधे 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 बोलो राधे राधा के बिना श्याम आधा कहते राधे श्याम जन्म जन्म के भाग जगा दे एक राधा का नाम बोलो राधे बोलो राधे बोलो राधे बोलो राधे बोलो राधे